Our moderator for our conversation this afternoon is the president of Phillips Theological Seminary, Dr. Gary Peluso-Verdend. Gary is also associate professor of practical theology at Phillips, an ecumenical seminary affiliated with the Disciples of Christ Church here in Tulsa. Gary's an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church and earned his Ph.D. at the University of Chicago Divinity School, advised by none other than Dr. Martin Marty. He has been so helpful to the Trialogue Committee this year in helping us shape our sessions. When our speakers are finished and we have a break, Gary will reconvene us and lead us in an active participatory presentation on civil discourse. So Gary's sitting right out here, front and center, and so we look forward to that.
Okay, first thing I'd ask you to do as you find your seat is could you give me, join with me in giving one more hand to those three presentations, which I think you'll all agree were really terrific. When I first joined with the committee, they were struggling some with how to approach the topic of extremism. And one of my first thoughts was, well, we tend to think of extremism only in the negative, but isn't there something positively to be said about extremism? And there was something rattling around in my head. So after that first meeting, I went and checked one of my historical documents, which would be Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail written in April 1963. Bishop Floyd referred to it, quoted from it. But the context you may remember is there's this group of Southern white clergymen who have written to King and said to him, support the cause, you're going way too fast. So back off, you're approaching this like an extremist. King wrote back, you speak of our activity in Birmingham as extreme. At first I was rather disappointed that fellow clergymen would see my nonviolent efforts as those of an extremist. I've tried to say that normal and healthy discontent can be channeled into creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. And now this approach is being termed extremist. But though I was initially disappointed as being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. And then he went on, was not Jesus an extremist for love? Was not an Amos an extremist for justice? Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? Was not Martin Luther an extremist? And John Bunyan? So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. We must never forget all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need for creative extremists. So this session on the good was, in fact, to give you examples of when you hear the word extremism, we typically think something first negative. But also know that's a label. It is a way of dismissing those that we don't agree with. And there is great power in naming. And that's going to come up again and again as we go through these three sessions together. I've been asked to help with the topic of civil discourse and extremism. We figured, well, that's a good one to start with. How often do we talk civilly even about what extremism is? So when we talk about civil discourse, I think the first thing I'm going to do is turn this on. Let's define what we mean. At least this is my working definition of it. Civil discourse is a practice. Like golf, like the way you cook, like the way you talk in your families, like the way you go about doing your job. It's a practice of conversation and argument. let's do include both, that has a characteristic characterized by honesty and mutual respect. Among people who have relatively equal power, regarding matters about which participants deeply disagree, and seeking understanding, a shared good, or common ground. We don't need civil discourse about matters on which we agree. You need to stay civil when we're engaged in matters of deep disagreement. So once again, it's a practice of conversation and argument characterized by honesty and mutual respect. It's that I see you as a human being at base that Sister Jackie talked about. Among people of relatively equal power, it's very difficult for real argument to happen between those who do not see each other as equals in some important way. Regarding matters about which participants deeply disagree, and seeking understanding, shared good, or a common ground. One of the resources I'd refer you to is on Krista Tippett's website on being.org, where she has there, she's a national public radio personality, and she's conducted for a couple of years Civil Conversations Project. And one of my favorite phrases I've pulled out of that project there thus far amongst people is amongst people who disagree but have gotten to the point where they at least understand each other, she says, she talks about achieving disagreement. Achieving disagreement. Sometimes achieving disagreement to really know and understand what it is you are disagreeing about is a genuine achievement. As I prepared for these three sessions, I have an overarching concern. This comes from being a lifelong Christian. This comes from being a seminary president. And that is, what are our faith communities doing to model and teach civil discourse? One of the phrases I heard in seminary from a Christian ethicist is that a congregation should be communities of moral discourse. I'd like you to hold that in mind. How is the religious congregation you know best a community of moral discourse? How do you, in the issues that vex your community, model and teach civil discourse? If you're like most congregations in the United States, you'd probably have to dig a little to find what the answer is and then put it against that definition I just had up there, you might find some of your own practices wanting. The fact is that incivility is a learned behavior. We've learned how to be uncivil to each other. And having civility in an absolutely flourishing democracy is going to require new habits over the ones that we practice. I mean, how many of you think that we're having a great civil discourse about anything important today in American society? Not very often. So my question, are our faith communities actively teaching how to have the conversations and arguments we need to have? Another way of saying this is your community more like Lake Wobegon or a Methodist stove? Many of you know Garrison Keillor, Prairie Home Companion, and what the way he characterizes Lake Wobegon is where the men are strong, the women are good-looking, and all the children are above average. Is that the way your congregation is when it comes to having arguments and conversation about the things that most matter? The above average? Or are you more like the Methodist stove? The late Jeff Smith, the frugal gourmet, you may remember from public television fame, he was a United Methodist clergyman, and he said sometimes you refer to a Methodist stove as in it gets hot when it wants to rather than when it should. I got really engaged when we had a conference at the seminary a little over a year ago on this topic of what should people of faith be contributing to civil discourse in the United States. And one of the speakers we had come, I didn't know about his project before he got a proposal to speak, It's from Scott Anderson, who's the director of the Wisconsin Council of Churches. And he came to us and talked about a project the churches in Wisconsin had engaged in to try to teach civil discourse throughout the state. Now, you may remember that Wisconsin got labeled by the New York Times as the most divisive political state in America after their governor, Governor Scott Walker, proposed to limit or end collective bargaining rights. And that kind of, they had various kinds of sit-ins, demonstrations, other things within at the Capitol for many days. Scott Anderson said, you know, for the most part, citizens of the state were pretty civil about it, but not so for our legislators, who engaged in all kinds of rancor, couldn't talk to each other. Some Democratic legislators actually left the state, hid out in Rockford, Illinois for a while as they were trying to avoid a vote on an issue that they didn't want to vote on and the like. It's also the case that this issue was tremendously divisive within congregations. So divisive, in fact, and I'm not making this up, and neither did Scott Anderson when he told us about it, congregations were so divided into pro-Walker and anti-Walker camps that many of them had to set up two different coffee and donut stations at fellowship hour because they could not talk to each other about it. If pastor mentioned anything from the pulpit, anything whatsoever, praying for our situation, if people get up and leave congregations, walking out. It made it so that the clergy didn't want to touch it at all. And remember, this is really pretty soon after the recession of 2008, which deeply impacted religious congregations and made more and more pastors concerned about people voting with their feet and walking out. So the Wisconsin Council of Churches decided to try to do something about this. And they partnered with the Center for Courage and Renewal, run by somebody many of you know, the name Parker Palmer, which is in Madison, Wisconsin. And they decided to try to impact the level of incivility by teaching through religious congregations how to engage in civil conversation. Now, they did this by setting up civility circles throughout the state. And they had some 400-plus people participate in them over their first season of effort in 6 2-hour sessions. Okay, now just want to underline, we have approximately 3 45-minute sessions, or after I'm done talking, and by the time you all talk, you'll have 3 20-minute sessions or thereabouts to practice some of this. So we have very humble outcomes we're expecting here. When they did circles, some in small churches, almost the entire town turned out, some suburban or city congregations. Universally, people said, this is the hardest work we have ever done. Trying to stay in the room and really listen and engage civilly with each other about the issues which vex us. They also said, by the way, that it was pitched at the wrong level to begin with. That starting with congregations addressing things politically was, in fact, too high, because as people learned what civil discourse was, they started saying things like, you know what? I don't practice this in my family. I don't practice this with my spouse. I don't practice this with my children. I don't practice this in my places at work. Maybe we need to learn this a little more fundamentally in the way we treat each other, with that kind of mutuality, respect as part of our everyday conversations. It's also the case that this worked a lot better in rural areas than in cities, because here was one of the absolute most interesting things I learned in the process of going about this conference and learned from them. What's the difference between a small town and a suburban area? In a small town, you really know you depend on everybody in that town. There's no shunning this person or that person off over there. There's no lifestyle enclave. There's no clique to go into. There's no place to withdraw into my kind versus your kind. Because the doctors and the insurance agent and the corner diner and all, that's all the same folks. Whereas in suburban and urban areas, do you really need each other? That's a fundamental question in civil discourse. We will not have civil discourse if either I think I don't need you, or I'm afraid that your bags are packed and you're walking if I say the wrong thing. Wisconsin decided our next step was to bring then this program to families and religious communities, and they have a brand new program, very curious what they're going to do. They have 60 clergy from around the state in an online course trying to teach them about civil discourse and healthy congregations. What they're trying to do is teach their religious communities to be vital educators for dealing with differences in public. Wow. Sounds like an awfully interesting project. A book I highly recommend that's on the reading list is Healing the Heart of Democracy by Parker Palmer, where he lays out a lot of the agenda for how to engage in civil discourse. And he's got 5 points that I want to just bring up here quickly. He says, these are habits of the heart that are necessary for democracy, and I dare say each of these will also be necessary for the good functioning of religious communities. An understanding that we're in this together, an appreciation of the value of otherness, an ability to hold tension in life-giving ways, a sense of personal voice and agency, and a capacity to create community. And if anyone wants to send me an email after this, I'll be happy to send you these slides, and I'm sure they'll also be on the OCCJ website before we're done. So what are we going to do in the 20 minutes, 22 minutes we have together in terms of engaging some and some civil discourse? I have very modest goals for what I would like to do together. They're modest and they're profound, I think, at the same time. I'm going to ask us basically about listening and understanding for just a few moments. First, to be hospitable. I love Omri Nouwen's definition, which looks something like this. Making room in your life for that which is not you without requiring that it becomes like you. Fundamental to civil discourse is good listening, which means making space for the other to see, in fact, what gift they might bring. Second, listen, and we're going to take some turns listening around the table, and please, this is going to be different from the way you often do small groups around tables. Everybody's not going to have a chance to speak. Some people are going to have a chance to speak today. Some are going to have a chance to listen. Please understand, listening may be the more important of the two as we practice a little bit here. And seek understanding. So this is basically what I'm asking you to do, is to consider the session we just concluded. Consider Bishop Floyd, who spoke about faith-based political action, about new monastics being extremists for love, and about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, restorative rather than retributive justice. Sister Jackie talking about compassion and Islam, and that one criterion that must be kept at all times, that you treat the other as they are, which is as a human being. Or Charles' 7 passions out of Judaism, whether that be survival, centrality of family, sense of mission, being an ethical monotheism, separating church and state, repairing the world, remembering, and the importance of Israel as a reminder of what was talked about. What did you hear? Perhaps there's somebody around the table who wants to begin, and pair up in twos. And if one of you has something, a question you've been percolating, please start. That's great. The other person, you're the listener. Yeah, I think your question was, why is it that we just all can't get along and love each other? No one tradition has a lock on the illegitimate use of our passions. Absolutely. So if I have this right, yeah, certainly discourse involves facts and opinions. To extrapolate off, seems like a lot of our incivility to each other is, and we'd all say this from our own perspective, opinions get substituted for facts, right? Unfortunately, what all the research shows us is that we listen first with our emotions. And our emotions are a very powerful filter for how we hear the so-called facts. You could have the best facts in the world, but if you're talking with someone who already has an emotional filter set that is opposed to the facts you have, those facts will be discounted in one way or another. Right. This is part of the challenge of civil discourse at all today, because we're also living in an era that's dominated by screens, right? And in that medium, conflict and emotion is king and queen. Right. So that's part of our challenge. And I'm begging the question for, and where in our culture do we have any possibility of learning a different way to be with each other? My gosh, I think the religious communities are one of those few places that might possibly yet be redeemable for this. Somebody else? Well, we're at 4:00, and the Super Bowl is going to be calling. Thank you very much for the experiment and engaging in conversation with each other.